for the rebound, saving it in. And Kerr snatches it out of the air and grills him.
With Scotty Love, I think Mike had a lot of confidence in me to knowing that I'm going to be there for him. I'm not going to let him down. I'm not going to let the team down. I'm going to let the city down. No.
That was the one and only Dennis Rodman describing his impact on the Chicago Bulls during Sunday's episode of Last Dance. It was one of the most unlikely fits in basketball history, sharing the floor with the sport's ultimate control freak, Michael Jordan. But somehow it worked. Today, we talked to a reporter who knew Rodman better than most because he lived with the NBA star for 2 weeks during the height of his fame. ESPN's Tim Kuhn joins us to relive the wild 90s and explains why Rodman was unlike any player or person he had ever met. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Monday, April 27th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Tim, did you watch last night?
I did.
Thank you for doing your duty as an ESPN employee. Tim Kuhn is a senior writer for ESPN. Tim, I am looking at a cover of the book, Bad As I Want to Be, and it has a picture of Dennis Rodman. He is naked. He is sitting backwards on a motorcycle. There is a strategically placed basketball. His hair is sort of tan and blonde. And on the bottom of the cover, it lists Dennis Rodman as the author in very big letters. And then right below that, in much smaller letters, it says, with Tim Kuhn, which begs the question, how did you come to be with Tim Kuhn and ghostwrite Dennis Rodman's autobiography?
My epitaph, with Tim Kuhn. You know, it started with a friend of mine, Mike Silver, who at the time was working at Sports Illustrated and had written the provocative cover story about Dennis, where he was on the cover wearing the feather boa with the parrot on his shoulder. Mike was supposed to write this book, and Sports Illustrated would not let him because he was an NFL writer at the time, and it would have taken up too much time of the season. So they put out kind of a casting call of writers, and Mike recommended that I put my name in the hat. Several of us interviewed with Dennis to see who might mesh best with him and who also might be able to finish a book in a shade under 3 months.
Wow.
And I interviewed with Dennis in a diner for breakfast in Anaheim with his agent at the time, who's a coin collector named Dwight Manley, who had just dipped his toe into sports agenting after he became friends with Dennis. Walked into this diner, sat down with the two of them. Dennis kind of said hi, kind of a grunt hi kind of thing. Yeah, I can remember the waitress coming over and Dwight ordering for both himself and Dennis, and Dennis just not ever even looking at the menu and thinking, this is going to be a tough book, you know, get 100,000 words out of a guy who doesn't even order his own breakfast. I kind of looked at it as a lark at the time. Lo and behold, a few days later, I got a call that I was chosen.
Why do you think you got the job?
It's funny. I've run that through my head so many different times, and I honestly think that I got the job because I was not desperate for the job. I think that I just kind of sat back and maybe gave off that impression that I was not going to be demanding to be his lifelong friend. You know, I wanted to hang out. I wanted to get the work done. I thought I could do the job well. And I had something in the way that I carried myself, I guess, hit a chord with Dennis and made it work.
So this was 1995. Dennis Rodman is already, you know, a known quantity. And as you mentioned, he had been on the cover of Sports Illustrated. He was fairly far along in his career. What was your perception of him going into this?
You know, I mean, at first I was a little bit just leery of the whole thing. At that time, there wasn't a whole lot positive coming out about Dennis.
Rodman shoves him. He's out of here.
He's gone. He knocked the policeman aside.
He did have this high profile.
Dennis Rodman with that wild hairdo of his.
A lot of it was because he was disrespectful to referees. He didn't get along with coaches.
Uh-oh. Now he's fighting one of his assistant coaches. Look at here.
I was very curious as to who was the guy behind all that.
It's getting really annoying when you've been too
nice, you got to go out there and kick somebody's ass. You got to play basketball. This nice.
What about as a basketball player? I mean, before you spent time with him, I imagine you spent a lot of time thinking about his play on the court and what he had achieved so far with his career. Where was he at that point?
Well, at that point, he had been established as probably the best rebounder in NBA history, especially for someone his size.
Dennis just got solid.
There's the worm doing his usual.
He had established early on that the way he was going to make his mark was by doing things that nobody else wanted to do, doing the menial tasks of basketball and almost refusing to shoot, which made no sense to almost anyone.
They can't stop Dennis Rodman.
His determination and the way that he played every possession like it was just a referendum on his self-worth, I think, was fascinating to me. I think it was so different from anybody else that we'd seen to this point.
Yeah, hard work, baby. Hard work. That's all it is. Hard work.
And at that moment, he was still on the Spurs.
He was, yes. He was rapidly playing himself off the Spurs.
Since his trade to San Antonio 13 months ago, Dennis Rodman has had 3 suspensions, 8 ejections, 40 technical fouls, and paid $54,250 in fines.
They were desperately trying to rid themselves of him, and it was actually with him when he got the call that they were trading him to the Bulls, which just spun everything in such a different direction. I mean, this book and Dennis's career and, you know, the world of basketball, everything changed with that phone call.
Before we get to that call and how it sort of led to everything we saw that transpired last night in The Last Dance, once Dennis had chosen you, what was your next move? What were the parameters you had for working with him?
Well, it became clear probably at that breakfast meeting that Dennis was not going to be someone who was going to be able to schedule meetings. That just wasn't the way his world worked. And so his agent said, okay, to do this, you're basically going to have to move in because he's not going to be on any kind of schedule. So I did 2 stints of living with Dennis Rodman that were about a week each. The parameters were that you pretty much just had to absorb yourself into his life because that was the only way to get the information that was going to be needed to write a book.
Did you get a sense from Dennis why he was doing a book and what he wanted to be in it?
He wanted to do a book in part because I think he felt like he had something to say to people that were like him, you know, people who had been marginalized and sort of shoved over to society's edge. And I think that he knew it was an incredible marketing opportunity for himself at that point. He had established himself as this flamboyant character in basketball, and he had gotten a lot of attention outside of basketball with his relationship with Madonna. And I think that this was something he saw as a way to sort of spread his name even outside of any kind of sport parameter.
So you're told you got to move in with him. At what point do you become a roommate of Dennis Rodman's?
It was late September of 1995, if I remember correctly, and it was at Dwight Manley's house in Orange, California. I slept on the couch, and I can remember at many points wondering if this book was ever going to be done, because Dennis, for all his flamboyance in the public eye, is a very shy, at times non-communicative person. There were a lot of really, really blank spaces on my audio tapes from that time. Dwight, his agent, at one point said, you know, the best way to deal with Dennis is get him in the car. If you get him in the car, he's captive. He will talk. And so, you know, we started going out, driving to Los Angeles, going different places. Dennis would be driving and talking and would tell me stories about his childhood and about how he fell into a basketball career so randomly. Even over the roar of the Ferrari engine, I could make out what Dennis was saying in the car. And, you know, it made a book, thankfully.
what kind of things did you witness while, you know, living with him and driving around with him? What kind of experiences did you have?
Well, I have to say I was like a, I think I was a 31-year-old father of three at the time. And my life was very different than Dennis Rodman's life. You know, I kind of lived by society's norms, you know, like I would never have thought to drive past a health club and just pull up and walk in and say, I'll be using that Stairmaster over there. But Dennis Rodman did those things. I can probably count four or five times that this happened where we'd just be driving somewhere and there had never been any talk of needing a workout or whatever, but he would just see a place and he would pull in and say, I think I'm going to go in here. And some kid behind the counter would just look up with his mouth just slack-jawed and say, okay, you know, and Dennis would just grab a towel and head for a Stairmaster and be on it for about an hour. I knew there were different rules for different people. I just didn't know that they could all be employed in this kind of way.
Did he seem at home in Los Angeles?
He liked being noticed. And, you know, there's no better place to be noticed than Los Angeles. He liked driving from Orange County into L.A. to, you know, for instance, get his nails done without an appointment again on a Saturday morning. Of course, I had had mine done the week before because I plan ahead.
Naturally.
He threw me the keys to his Ferrari, and I, at the time, was driving a 78 Honda Civic, and I just wasn't ready for the power, Mina. I couldn't quite handle the car. So we pull out onto Rodeo Drive, and it's like a basketball going down the Rodeo Drive. I'm stalling every 6 or 8 feet, and the top's down, and Dennis's hair is fuchsia, and everybody's driving by laughing at him, and I'm laughing, and Dennis is probably the only one who's not laughing. His nails dried very quickly, as it turned out, so that he could get back behind the wheel.
Tim, you mentioned that Rodman felt he had something to say to those who felt marginalized. Did you witness that in regards of how he connected with people around you?
You know, for one thing, he loved West Hollywood. Obviously, he had developed a following among gay culture because of his embrace of the AIDS cause at that time, which was pretty outside the norm in professional sports, especially to color the AIDS ribbon in the back of your hair and play in an NBA game that was nationally televised. I mean, that just wasn't something that coaches were encouraging at that time, let's put it that way. And he went into West Hollywood the day that he got his nails done. And I can remember he went into the store and he bought a shirt that said, I'm not gay, but my boyfriend is. And it had an arrow on it. And then we walked around for the rest of the day with him wearing that with the arrow pointing at me. And I think he thought it was going to shock me. And I didn't care. I thought it was kind of funny. But just things like that were silly. And every time he walked into a store there, they all came up to him and thanked him. I mean, people were very grateful for the fact that they felt that he was taking their cause in a way and their concerns into a much wider arena, you know, so to speak. And he did it almost by force. There was no one encouraging him to do that within the structure of professional basketball or the NBA. But he did it anyway, and he got a lot of people who didn't care about basketball cared about Dennis Rodman.
Tim, as you mentioned, that embrace of gay culture was not only unusual at the time in the 90s, it remains unusual, I think, amongst a lot of sports today. Why do you think he landed on that approach? What was it about him or his past or the way he saw the world that led him down that path?
Well, you know, Mina, I think a lot of what he was feeling was, as he told me for the book, that he felt that there were parts of him in a way that were bisexual. He felt that he had feelings for other men. And his thing was that he felt that everybody at some time or another wonders what it would be like to be the other, essentially. And I think that was sparked a little bit by his relationship with Madonna, because she at the time also was into sort of challenging gender and looking at the world in the same way that Dennis was. And I think that he floated it without really knowing how it was going to be accepted when he found that there was this whole group of people whether it was in the gay community or whether it was just people that were different. I mean, he became their hero. He was speaking for them, and it was really a unique moment in sports.
When you were driving around Los Angeles and he was telling you about his life story, what resonated with you even to today?
I think it was just the randomness of it all. The fact that this was a guy who really never even played high school basketball, was working at the Dallas airport, got arrested for stealing watches that he gave away to his friends just because he was so insecure and his self-esteem was so bad. It wasn't like he was stealing for money. He was stealing for acceptance. And just to go from that person, that fragile person, to this international superstar. I mean, as a journalist, you know, it those stories are so rare, but they're so fascinating in terms of just not only how does it happen, but how do you handle it once it does happen? I think that he, more than a lot of athletes, thought about those things. He actually thought about how random it was that he got where he was. It kind of manifested itself in him being almost masochistic. He wanted to throw his body on the floor. He wanted to see how much he could drink the night before a game and still perform. There's so much material there with Dennis that I still don't fully understand, but I'm still fascinated by.
All right, in a moment, let's talk about the time you met Michael Jordan and what it was like watching your book take on a life of its own. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Tim, the very first line of the autobiography is, on an April night in 1993, I sat in the cab of my pickup truck with a rifle in my lap, deciding whether to kill myself. Why did you guys decide to start with that?
Dennis had a theory that what he did that night was figuratively kill the old Dennis Rodman and bring into life this new Dennis Rodman. He was definitely suicidal. He admitted that. He definitely was thinking about ending his life in that parking lot. But this sort of agreement that he came to with himself was that he could not continue being that person that towed the company line, that tried to be happy, that tried to get along with every teammate, that tried to be what other people thought he should be. And so that's why we started with that, because it really was the beginning of everything that we have come to know Dennis Rodman for.
At one point in The Last Dance, Rodman says, "I'll play the game for free. They pay you for the bullshit." Is that what he's referring to, what you just described?
Definitely. And that's like poetry, isn't it? I mean, if a guy says that, that's just, I could just imagine the guys sitting there with their notebooks thinking, oh, yeah. That is really what gets at the core of his struggle, which was that he loved basketball. He loved the outlet, the expressiveness that it allowed him. But he didn't like the infighting with teammates. He didn't like coaches and general managers and deciding who he would be and how he would play. He had this iconoclastic streak that was very anti-authoritarian, but it also really clashed with his love for the game and his love for teammates and the rhythms of the season and games and just the way that the whole geometry of basketball that he fell in love with. It really was at odds with this corporate structure.
So let's get back to that phone call about the trade. How did it come about? How did it play out? And what did you witness from Dennis's side of things?
It was sort of rumored that he would be traded, and the Bulls seemed like a logical spot for him in many ways, just because they had a need. And if anyone could handle Dennis, it was thought that Phil Jackson would be the coach who could bring out the best in him. But when the call came and it was final, I can remember his agent took the call, Dwight took the call, then Dennis got on the phone briefly, and you know, when he hung up, he was like, "Well, I'm a Bull now." It was like there was this pause, like where everyone sort of digested what that meant. The scope of it with Michael Jordan and, you know, Michael coming back just recently from baseball, and what that team would look like with him, just what it would look like from a global standpoint as this traveling circus. And yeah, there was this pause like, oh wow, that's more than just changing teams. This is a big deal.
Did you think it would work?
I wasn't sure, but I thought that it would be so much fun to watch that it wouldn't matter if it worked or not. But I think early on in talking to Dennis in the hours probably after that call, I can remember him talking so graciously and respectfully about Michael Jordan. And he had a list of grievances a mile long, but with the fact that he talked about Michael in the way that he did made me think that it could work, that this was something that he actually wanted to work. And if that part was taken care of, then it would work.
So right before you finished the book, you went to Chicago to see how it was working out, whether Dennis was settling in. What did you find when you got there?
Well, I found a Residence Inn loft suite with Jack Haley and Dennis Rodman living in the same two-room suite. Jack was kind of the designated babysitter that year. Jack was on the team all year and played in one game, which is just like really hard to do. I also was around for a few days, and one day after practice, I was walking around the complex with Dennis, and I was already beyond where I should have been with my credential, but I just was with Dennis, so I kept going. And then he said, I gotta go work out. And the place was empty. Practice was over. Felt like everyone was gone. Go into the weight room, and he wanted me to spot him on the bench press. So I was helping him, and I detected movement on the other side of the room. And I look, and just staring me straight in the face is Michael Jordan. And I'm thinking, okay, this is me and Dennis Rodman and Michael Jordan are just like hanging out in the gym. You know, this is
casual.
Cool. Just, yeah, whatever, you know, every day. I kind of got all red in the face because I could tell Michael was like, who the hell, right? I hung out for one more set, and then I turned around and I sent someone from behind me, and yeah, there's Phil Jackson. He's standing at the entrance to the weight room, and he's like, it's time to go. And so it was Phil, Dennis, Michael, and me just kind of hanging out, doing some reps, getting swole.
Just you and your peers.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we were all about the same age, so what the heck.
So, Tim, when this book came out, it was a big deal.
It was a really weird big deal for me because it was like this out-of-body experience. You know, I'm getting calls from the publisher saying, hey, the books are in a warehouse in Chicago and we've had to hire armed guards to stand outside them. And Dennis does the book signing in the wedding dress and marries himself.
Basketball star Dennis Rodman had announced he'd get married, but he showed up as the bride.
You know, I've always thought that the most beautiful thing about a bride is the nose rings. I think that's a very attractive look.
I'm just sitting at home like, what did I do here? It's just so weird.
In a world where attitude and image are everything, it's Dennis Rodman's universe and we're all just living in it.
People would ask me, so are you going to do a book tour? I'm like, am I going to do a book tour? Are you watching this guy? I can only screw this up. Trust me. He's handling this very well.
I do enjoy the idea of people showing up for a Dennis Rodman autobiography book tour and seeing you sitting at a table.
Yes, exactly. That would be, I'm sure, everyone's dream. That would be, you could, if there's a such thing as negative book sales, like people returning them, that would have been.
So, Tim, you know, the Bulls ride with Dennis Rodman, it begins after you finish the book. What was it like watching that from afar? What did you make of the rest of his career?
I thought it was remarkable to watch how well he fit into that ecosystem of the Bulls and how happy he seemed.
Those are the plays that Dennis Rodman does to make his team great. Awesome.
Especially that first year when they're winning 72 games and everything's just smooth and Phil Jackson has his back at every possible turn.
The Chicago Bulls have won the NBA championship.
You know, and I really think that the combination of Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson saved Dennis's career. And if not saved, they definitely prolonged it because he was very close to radioactive when he left San Antonio. And he could have very easily bounced from team to team and one-year contract to one-year contract after that had he not fallen into a team that had that kind of cohesiveness and that kind of coach who understood personalities the way Phil Jackson did.
So watching last night, seeing not only, you know, a recap of what happened with the Bulls, but also Dennis Rodman's life and who he is today, do you think back in 1995, you would have foreseen any of this? I'm setting aside him becoming an informal ambassador to North Korea, because I know you did not foresee that, Tim.
No.
But what did you make of how things turned out for him?
I think from a basketball standpoint, the fact that he made the Hall of Fame, I knew that was kind of a career goal for him and something that he took pride in because of the way that he got there, unconventionally, both his background and also the way he played. You know, I have to admit to a little sadness when I see some of the ways his life has turned out. Just the raw emotion he's shown, the issues he's had personally. Those things make me kind of sad because I know at the root, he's a very generous, thoughtful person who sometimes doesn't know how to get out of his own way. There's a lot of insecurities in there. There's a lot of self-esteem issues, as we've talked about. I feel like as a basketball player, he got the absolute most out of what he brought to the table. And I just hope that he can find more peace in later years. And maybe some of this, the spotlight kind of coming back and people looking at it a little bit more, looking at him with a more endearing view might help that.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you, Mina.
Coming up, some of the superlatives of the NFL draft. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit.
Here are some numbers I want you to know. The NFL draft this weekend was unprecedented for obvious reasons. But beyond the virtual aspect of it all, it was historic in other ways, too. Consider some of these facts, courtesy of our Stats and Info group. If you were watching at home and every time the Vikings run the clock, you found yourself saying, again, really? Well, you weren't wrong. Thanks to some savvy trades, the Vikings drafted 15 players, the most by any team since the draft switched to 7 rounds in 1994. As expected, this was an incredibly rich draft for wide receivers. 13 wideouts were taken in the first 2 rounds, the most in NFL history, and 36 were taken overall, a tie for the most ever. One team that did not draft any? The Packers, who many thought would take one in the first round. Meanwhile, the Jaguars took a quarterback in the 6th round, Oregon State's Jake Luton, marking the 4th time they've done so in the last 5 years. That is twice as many as any other team. Many people thought the Panthers would go heavy on defense, given how much talent they've lost, but they didn't just double down on that side of the ball. They septupled down. Doesn't really make sense, but you know what I mean. GM Marty Herney used all 7 of his draft picks on defensive players. That is the first time that has happened since the AFL-NFL merger. The Patriots also focused on defense, despite the fact that, unlike Carolina, they were very good last year. And in spending 3 of his first draft picks on defense, Bill Belichick became the first GM since the merger to do that after leading the NFL in total defense the year before. Well, I say Bill Belichick did it, but it could have been his dog Nike, who seemed to have some input in decision-making if you're watching the draft. So I suspect he was probably kept on a short leash. I'm Ina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.